Hey listeners, Chloe here. If you need to stay as up to date with the latest developments and innovations in the luxury industry as I do, you need to dive into Vogue Business. It's your ticket to a global perspective on fashion and beauty, delivering exclusive insights that will give you the edge in this competitive, dynamic industry. Just visit VogueBusiness.com today and use the code RUN20 at checkout to join the Vogue Business community. That's VogueBusiness.com, promo code RUN20. Don't miss out.
This is The Run Through with Vogue. I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel. Today, we go to Paris to speak with Simon Porte-Jacquemus. I actually went to Paris to speak with him. If you don't know him, you should. He's a delightful young designer who makes very large straw hats and very tiny purses. And he has a new show next week in Paris.
And we speak with Chelsea Manning about her new book, her life after prison, and of course, her love of fashion.
But first, this week's headline. Choma, you might think there's only one big drop today, being our episode of The Run Through. But in fact, there's another moment that people are talking about, which is...
Let me guess.
Harry and Meghan.
Yes!
Their Netflix documentary is finally streaming.
Finally.
And people have been having a field day with the trailer all week. Ooh, the trailer is, it's rough.
Let's unpack it.
At this moment in my life and my cultural awareness, I'm like, get out of here. Enough. We are done.
Right. So we have many royal enthusiasts on our team, but we have one in particular who is a freelancer, Michelle Ruiz, who's written many great pieces and has been watching the royals for pretty much her entire life. She's American. And even for her, this feels like overkill.
Interesting.
Yeah, she wrote a piece about whether this is a documentary we actually want or need. And I can see, you know, I mean, I can see the appeal. I think, you know, from watching the trailer, and if you've been under a rock and haven't seen it, basically, it is like a highlight reel of their relationship.
Well, it's a lot of... like close-up shots of Meghan, like sort of gripping her head in this like agony.
There were some funner moments than that. There is a picture of her pregnant, and you know,
let me tell you, that ain't fun.
Love the photo booth photos of them kissing. Like there are some tender moments. Mm-hmm. It goes high low. I mean, it's like pleasure pain. Like it's the full scope of emotions.
All right,
but it's their interior life, which I think for a lot of people makes it, and especially, you know, talking to Michelle, who wrote the story, you know, she thinks that that is a bridge too far, that the whole point of the royal family is that there should be some intrigue, some mystery. And it's something that, you know, Prince Charles and Princess Diana wouldn't have probably agreed to or done or...
Well, I just watched the Crown episode where she does the Martin Bashir interview,
right.
And it's... has real shades of that. I mean,
right.
This is not Guy Fawkes Day, but it's close to a sort of a bomb detonation. But also I think people took some issue with some of their claims or the suggestions of the trailer. Like,
right.
Like any good journalist, I get my news from the New York Post. And the Post was pointing out that in one of the sort of voiceovers of Harry talking about how besieged they've been by the press and how harassed, one of the images used was a photo of them on their visit to Desmond Tutu, and that had been an approved photo. And so why are they using that? They're manipulating the narrative, which... fine. I mean, I do feel like Meghan is so hyper on message and so rehearsed that it just, there's nothing fun about it.
Right. But me, what really offends me or what I find tricky is we pick a trailer that is essentially 1 minute and 15 seconds long, right? How many articles did you see in the tabloids? It is dissected to the point where you're just like, can we just chill for a second? Literally, I saw a caption on one of the Daily Mail stories that was picking apart the fact that there was an Hermes blanket in the back of one of those crying images.
Apparently, those are sold out.
That just shows you the power this couple has or the influence that Meghan has. And I understand that everyone's saying, oh, yeah, she's on messages on this. And, you know, and there was, it's been fodder for morning talk shows in the UKs for days. And it was interesting because I was watching this one clip and The hosts were basically saying, do we feel that this documentary will actually reveal the moment that things turned, right, went sour?
Because interesting.
There was kind of this sense of hope when Meghan joined the royal family, but it quickly turned.
Right.
And it's kind of still a mystery to everyone what exactly went down.
Okay.
And I do think if this docuseries reveals anything, if it reveals that, then I think there'll be something to it. Because even the Oprah interview, I didn't really get a sense of, like, at what point did things go wrong? Because they weren't always wrong.
Right.
You know, even though things were kind of set up in a terrible way.
Right.
And let's not forget that what happened last week at Buckingham Palace, where, you know, a member of the royal family, you know, made these hugely racist comments to a British woman.
Yeah. Not just any lady in waiting. She is Prince William's godmother and a subject of one of the recent Crown episodes. Her husband was the chairman of the BBC during the Bashir interview. This is all coming full circle.
If she still hasn't got the memo that racism is not okay, then there's still issues there. I can see all the things, but I do think we can't forget that.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm a bit bored of Meghan and Harry at this point. I'm
a
bit bored
of them.
If
you have to come down, yes or no, are you pro or con?
No,
Meghan?
I'm not allowed. That's not fair.
That is fair.
No. It's not that straightforward. I go back and forth. I think after the Oprah interview, there were parts of it that turned me off, but then parts of me thought, oh, you know, I don't, I don't know. I had TBD.
I go back and forth too. One concern for them is, I don't know if her brand of like plucky optimist female empowerment is really relevant anymore. I feel like her message and this brand that she's building is very 2012, 2013. It's sort of like The Tig Grows Up, which was her sort of lifestyle blog. And I like, you listen to her podcast and it's like, okay, like it's this just like women supporting women. It just doesn't feel very complex or updated. And
maybe that's why they're doing this docuseries, because I think they understand that this is what the people want. People do want to see as much of their interior lives as they can. And this is basically blowing open the gates to their romance. And it's a fairy tale story. You know, I mean, everything about her, she just was the most unlikely match for a prince.
What is the next step? Because this is basically, now they're showing all the cards.
We know what the next step is. January 10th.
Okay, now they're out. So
is the book, right? The
Spare comes out.
Spare comes out.
And then there's nothing left. I mean, they have Archwell, but let me tell you, Archwell is not well. I do feel like the only audience they have left is the U.S.
Yeah,
I feel like the elite media-obsessed Americans are really the only sweet spot that will still come calling and care about them. And they've been smart to cater to that demographic. The British press are just done.
I mean, the British press have never treated them very well.
No, that's true. So
the future is unclear.
Yes.
But they're definitely, they've broken the internet twice with 1.15 minute thing.
I'm sort of ready to be done. Like, wake me up when the nude leaks. So, speaking of the Brits, Choma, tell me about the British Fashion Awards, because I actually have no idea who won any awards. I just looked at the pictures.
For me, it's always about the red carpet.
Yeah, okay. Tell me
So let's just
dress.
Talk about the dresses. I thought Kristen McManamy.
Yes, I like that too.
Yeah. So basically, you know, Valentino pink has been the color, right, for the past, you know, two seasons.
They're really elevating Barbiecore into a different realm.
Exactly. It is exactly that shade of pink.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I was tired of it. But then, you know,
Kristen changed your mind.
Yeah, out comes Kristen McManamy. You know what did it for me?
Yes.
So her dress was this long, you know, kind of cape-like.
Maybe phi, like silk phi.
Right.
You can tell what it was.
Exactly. But it was kind of studded with feathers.
Yeah.
And what really made it for me were that she had feathered pink
The eyelashes were
eyelashes.
Incredible. She looked like Twiggy
beauty
on
of
acid.
The night. It was like, exactly. It was Twiggy on acid. I think Twiggy was on acid. Rumor has it. But and then she had these sort of long, you know, she has this incredible long mane of white hair.
Yeah.
And she had it partially braided. And it was just
It was a full look.
It was a full look.
No, I agree. For me, like, the ones, people who really went for it were the most fun of the night. Like, Erin O'Connor in her, like, Las Meninas sort of black mourning veil over her erdem. It was very cool.
Right. What did you think of Tilda Swinton? She wore...
I don't know that designer. Charles Jeffrey Loverboy?
Right. So Charles Jeffrey Loverboy, I actually happen to own some of his clothing.
Okay. Name on his birth certificate, or do we think that's an evolution?
That's a good question. I'll get back to you on that.
Okay.
I really love his brand.
You love Loverboy?
I love Loverboy.
Okay.
The reason that you may not have heard of it is because he usually shows on the menswear schedule.
Oh,
so he's known as a menswear designer, but he's just got this terrific punk energy.
Okay.
And I just thought it was, I mean, Tilda plus Charles Jeffrey Loverboy is just a perfect kind of storm.
For people who did not happen to see Tilda in Loverboy, it was a jacket over a dress, but with sort of Picasso-esque abstract sort of faces drawn on to it.
Yeah, and what was nice was that underneath it, she wore this. He uses a lot of tartans and checks and plaids.
Is Tilda Scottish?
Exactly. Okay. So that I thought it was a nice nod to her Scottish roots.
All right. Choma liked Tilda and Loverboy. I liked a different dress this week that Choma's making a face like I just farted in the studio. Julia Roberts to the Kennedy Center Awards, which was honoring George Clooney. Choma, by the way, is still making the face. Her she is not eased. She's going to need to use a lot of retinol tonight. Julia Roberts wore to honor George Clooney a Moschino dress that Jeremy Scott made for her with frames of George Clooney's face all over the dress. Of course it's bad, but it's funny. I'm so sick of everyone taking themselves so seriously.
I just, maybe it was just absurd.
Yes, but that's funny.
But she's just not that girl. Since when? And it just was like...
Maybe she is.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know what? It shows me she has a sense of humor. You're right. I should be less... I just was confused by it. It was just so...
It was confusing,
bizarre.
But it was also sort of funny.
Are they that close?
Yes, they're best buddies.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I just think it looks obsessive to show up with someone's face all over
the
dress.
That's what's funny about it.
Okay.
I mean, it's like there's no more, everyone has a stylist now. Everything's so planned out, so media trained. It's like, let's get a Bjork Swan back in the mix.
I was just thinking that.
Yes.
I was just thinking it felt a bit like that. But when Bjork did it, it really wasn't meant to be like.
Who made that swan? Was it a designer or is she just some weird Icelandic person?
I think it was a designer.
Okay.
We'll have to get back to you on that.
All right. You've got a few outstanding questions to be answered next week.
The internet and Google is my best friend. We'll get back to you.
So big news this week.
Yeah.
I know no one really comes to us for their political news, but it is very exciting that Raphael Warnock won the Georgia runoff Tuesday night.
Thank goodness. Can we just breathe a huge sigh of relief?
It was a huge sigh of relief. And it really sort of put in relief what a battleground state Georgia has become and what a shift it has been. I mean, for him to win twice in a row, it's sort of remarkable. And there's just going to be a shift in where we're watching and what we're tracking. And I think this was an interesting indicator of that ahead of time. You know, they had a Republican political strategist who the Times interviewed. And she was like, you know, it's up to the soccer moms and the Peloton dads. And, you know, which was just to symbolize that the real tipping point now is going to be these white college educated suburban parents, basically.
Right.
Like those are the people who you want to tip the scale towards Democrats. But I was kind of pissed because it was like, so the soccer moms are not exercising themselves. They're going to their kids' soccer games. But the Peloton dads get to work out alone at 6 a.m. before they have to go to work. It just felt very sort of 1950s,
I thought
but with a Peloton.
Pelotons anymore.
Well, I don't know. This woman, I had it all wrong. It made me very grumpy.
I will say that I think Herschel Walker's concession speech, I was actually...
I didn't hear it.
Well, it was probably like the most sense he's ever made.
Okay.
And I was glad he made it because, you know, being such a Trumper, you would think that he would just scream election.
Yeah.
Denial in a heartbeat, but his concession, he conceded pretty quickly and, you know, with some, you know, pretty graciously, you know, given that he hasn't been particularly.
Well, hopefully we won't be hearing from him for a while.
No, exactly. Yeah. And I thought the acceptance speech was that Raphael Warnock's acceptance speech is really moving. And he just talked about being from Georgia. And
I know. He was, I am a Georgian. Yeah. And it was very, felt very powerful.
Yeah. Some people were saying, oh, could you imagine him as president? I don't know. I couldn't imagine him as a candidate. But I felt like certain people were suggesting it online.
But anyway, bravo to Senator Warnock. And
goodbye, Herschel.
Yeah. In just as urgent news, I have been delighted. I feel like since the streaming generation, there's very rarely a collective TV moment. And White Lotus, feel like, has really stepped into that moment. The internetification of this show has been so much fun. It's like this group sport to make memes of it, find the clues. It's like a Hansel and Gretel story for 2022.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually going to be in a plane when the last episode. I know. I'm really gutted, actually.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I have two children under three, so I usually go to bed before 10 p.m.
It on a Monday?
So I usually watch it on a Monday. But so you and I can.
How are you going to escape all the spoilers?
Well, I don't go on the internet on Monday.
Okay,
that's not true. But I mean, I try to avoid spoilers.
So what's your theory?
So, well, I shared my theory with the, like, Vogue, Vogue.com Slack, and I was like, well, I think that it's, you know, Tom Hollander, the gay villa owner, is actually in love with Jennifer Coolidge's husband, and that was the cowboy in the picture, and I was quickly shut down. I was like, yes, all of TikTok shares your theory. I was like, oh, I'm such a grandmother. But a grandmother, Miss Marple, if any grandmother.
Well, you'll be pleased to know I did not know that theory, so that you
okay,
just enlightened me, and I'm quite impressed by that.
I mean, didn't you say, Choma, that the piece you guys did on are Portia's outfits good or bad, people loved it? I mean,
people
there's really been...
it.
People what do we call
it?
Secondary content? The White Lotus?
I mean, you know, Portia's outfits. Yeah, I mean, they continue to be terrible, I think. They continue
the piece
to,
was,
so
are Portia's
good.
Outfits good or
I
bad?
Guess so bad they're good in some people.
Well, they just feel like it's really nailing a very specific 20-something Gen Z.
It's very TikTok
style.
It's like every TikTok trend converged.
After the break, Paris.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi everyone, it's Chloe, and I'm so excited to share something fabulous with you, Vogue's first ever global fashion community, Vogue Club. Our members get to mingle with Vogue editors, yes, including me, and fellow fashion enthusiasts at exclusive events around the world, and that's just the start. Membership opens doors to the fashion industry, bringing you expert career advice and insider style and beauty tips. What are you waiting for? Head over to Vogue.com/membership to join, and here's a little treat. Use code TRT20 and snag 20% off your membership. That's TRT20 for 20% off your ticket to Vogue Club. Are you in?
I'm standing on the Avenue Montaigne. It is one of the tonier shopping boulevards in Paris. And we are about to enter the new Jacquemus store. So, back to Paris and the Avenue Montaigne, where Jacquemus is opening his new store this evening. Across the street is Balenciaga, next door is Gucci. He's really in the big leagues here, hitting high. And let me just putting on
fixing my jacket. I walked here from my hotel, so I'm a little rumpled.
Chloe, I know you're not rumpled. You're never rumpled.
I was rumpled.
Right, maybe. But I know you want to put a look together for Simon. He's an amazing designer. I mean, he dresses the likes of Dua Lipa, Beyonce, Rihanna, so you're in good company. I mean, he's also really an outlier. He takes his collections to the most fantastic places, like far from Paris, you know, to the lavender fields of Provence or beaches of Hawaii.
His latest collection, which is featured in the new store Le Papier, he showed it, if you can imagine, in the salt marshes of Provence. Mm. And it was all in shades of white and beige that matched the salt hills. It was très dramatique.
And it was also a look we saw in his recent wedding, too, right? Where his grandmother walked him down the aisle in one of those spectacular ivory dresses. There's actually a great story about it on Vogue.com.
We on a rendezvous avec Simon pour Vogue.
It was noon in Paris. So sorry, Choma, it was 6 a.m. for you.
I mean, I was barely awake, but I came dressed in my favorite bubblegum pink sweater, Giacomo sweater, via Zoom to chat with both of you.
Bonjour.
Bonjour. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm very cozy in my Giacomo sweater.
Oh, I see. The pink. Oh, this one is good.
It's gotten me through.
That's a very good lockdown sweater.
Yeah, I wore it so much. I think my colleagues got tired of it.
Oh, I see what you mean. Do you mean you sleep in the Giacomo sweater? I see. What a luxury.
Not quite.
But Simon, we're in Simon's beautiful new store. They have their opening tonight and then it's fully opening tomorrow morning. And it looks so gorgeous. Were you very involved in designing this?
Yeah, I did.
Every detail?
I did it. Like basically, I designed my showroom in that mood and then all beige.
There's muslin curtains, sort of raw muslin curtains covering all the walls. And it's all many shades of from white to eggshell to sort of salted butter. And it's extremely calming, but also very precise. And all of the clothes hanging that I've seen are, especially in the room that we're sitting in, are all white, and they're from the Papier collection.
Right.
Will you tell us a little bit about where that showed?
This show in south of France, in a salt desert. We created this massive salt mountain. It was really space age, weird, like
Mad Max.
Yeah, like being on the moon, kind of. Yeah, I wanted something like super pure. For this collection, like all white, but something quite drama and poetic. So, yeah.
Even watching your shows from afar, they're so spectacular. I mean, you had Hawaii and you had Provence. I mean, you've really stepped away from the traditional calendar, but also from Paris. Like, and it's really refreshing to see young designers break the rules. Yeah. Why did it feel right for you to do that?
Because I haven't the option, you know. I want my brand to be seen back in the day. So when I did my first show in Paris, I used a swimming pool.
Empty?
And then, no, just around the swimming pool.
Oh, okay. The swimming pool was full of water.
But it
nobody
was
fell in, I hope.
Yeah, no one. But it just also to say, like, yeah, I want to do something different. I just don't want, like, a lookbook, model walking out of a lookbook that is not sexy, it's not fun, so I want to tell a story.
What happens if there's bad weather?
Well, it didn't rain on your wedding, and I have to say congratulations. It looked beautiful, and obviously you got married in your hometown.
Town.
Yeah, tell me what you remember about that day.
Wow, it was so special. It was so important to me to be back in my hometown. Like, makes so much sense, because we visit so much place, like so much fancy place, I have to say. And I was like, no, it's not right. I want to be back in the place where I grew up.
And where is that? What is the village called?
It's called Charleval. Mm-hmm. It's a very small town in the south of France, an hour away from Marseille.
And did you get married in the Marie or?
Yeah, it was so beautiful. Like the whole village was there, like everyone was like at the balcony watching us. It was weird at the same time, but it was cute because I always was the gay of my village. So coming back and being applauded by people, feeling only love was...
As a gay couple.
Yeah, as a gay couple means so much.
I know you said that your grandfather was worried that people might throw tomatoes at you or not be welcoming.
Oh, I didn't know I said that, but yes, it's true, because my grandfather couldn't sleep at night. I was like, are you okay? He was like, no, I'm afraid that people send tomato on you. I was like... It will not happen. Like, it's going to
so
be
touching.
Fine. People are going to share love. And of course, I know we're a gay couple, but it's because we're famous that people also are that enthusiastic. But it helps at the end of the day, you know? Yeah. It helps the gay cause, so... Yeah.
A lot of small town weddings in France. My husband and I also got married in a small town near where my father has a house or had a house. And the entire village becomes part of the wedding.
Yeah.
It's not just those people you invited. It's everyone who lives there. It's a whole village event, whether you want it to be or
exactly.
not. And it's such a thrill. So Simon talking about people coming out, these are not the people he invited. These are everyone who lives there. These are the old men who maybe taught him in school.
Yeah, just to see them, I was crying already.
It was also the village, but you had some special guests. I mean, how did everyone in the village react to having like Dua Lipa be in your town?
My
I'm sure God. That's like the most celebrities that have ever been in your town in one go.
Yeah, but of course, like my town, like no one ever passed by, you know, like it's it's such a small town with like nothing really to do. Mm-hmm. I love it, huh? But they were crazy to see Dua. They were so cute.
And Dua in very little clothing.
Oh my God.
I mean, it was for a traditional French village, which she was wearing a completely sheer dress with sort of a bikini underneath or sort of underwear.
Yeah, it's a transparent like
But it
dress.
Was quite a look for a Provençal.
Yeah, but I love because she asked me, she was like, oh, do you like? I was like, yeah, it's my favorite dress for you.
What collection was it from? Of
this one.
This papier?
Yeah, this Le Papier collection.
So in a way, it was sort of a second runway of sorts.
It was the second show of the house. That's so fun. But what's the most fun about it, I have to tell you, it was the comment the next day. Oh my God, the comments.
These are comments on Instagram. Yeah.
Oh, I don't understand why Dua is wearing a wedding dress. The braid, must be so sad. And people commenting, it's a gay wedding. The dress was done by Simon himself. What are you saying? And then another good comment that I need to tell you. I don't understand why the bride is so old. No, it's my grandmother, guys.
Oh, amazing.
Like, she was my best dressed. She was the best dressed.
That's
I love her.
I draw this one.
Yeah. Your grandmother must have been so touched.
My grandmother. She's going to be like, yes, I could be with
you. We call this a May-December romance when it's a big age difference.
big age, yeah. But she's 76, so.
Well, she
dress,
looks fabulous. Like, can you describe the dress a little bit that
it's wore? It's a bustier white dress, like super minimal with just...
Sort of bubble.
Yeah,
a little,
bubble. Yeah. Like, and like just a knot on the back, all in a white like linen.
And can you tell us a little bit about the inspirations for this upcoming collection?
It's hard to say, like this one was a really like forever collection, all white, drama, poetry, about my wedding. I think the next one will be a tiny more fashion.
Do you feel that whatever's happening in your personal life, it spills
always.
Into this?
Okay. I can't lie.
So where do you spend the holidays?
In South of France, in my house.
With your grandmother or?
Not all time, but...
Okay.
A month with her, I kill her or she kill me. We are like so connected, then yeah, we'd be not possible.
What's the dress code? Like, what's the dress code in the south of France? How do people get dressed up? Or is it more casual?
For Christmas?
What's it like
for
in
Christmas?
Your house? Yeah, in your house for Christmas.
Oh my God, my family? No, they try. They keep on trying every Christmas, but...
Do you have traditions? Like there's always Christmas lunch or Christmas dinner or you all take a walk?
I always do a Christmas party, but we eat the same thing. We open the present the same hours like each year. So I say, okay, basta. I can't live in this movie anymore. Let's have a big party. We drink. And
what's the cocktail of the party? Is there one drink that everyone's having?
No, not really. Rosemary with alcohol. We love rosemary.
Wow. Interesting. That sounds good.
Yeah, it's a very Jacques Mus cocktail, this one.
I know you have a jam-packed day before.
Yeah. Beautiful, but it's fun, huh? This little...
Yeah. No, we're thrilled to be able to do it with you here.
Yes. To follow Chloe on her travels. It's been really fun.
Exactly. All right. Well, merci beaucoup, Simon.
Merci à vous. Thank you, Vogue.
And good luck with the opening tonight.
Yeah, it's going to be so fun.
It sounds
amazing. My grandmother is on the way and she was like, can I wear the dress from the wedding? I was like, no,
you
it's
can.
Too soon. No, it's too soon, darling. I was like, you wear it for your anniversary next year, but 1 week after, hello. No, Have a good day.
You too.
Ciao, ciao.
Bye.
I want to go to a holiday party with drink, drink, drink and rosemary with alcohol.
I'm sure his show in Paris is basically going to be a holiday party.
His show in Paris is going to be the holiday party he just described.
Basically.
Hey, Run Through listeners. Are you curious about what goes on behind the scenes at Vogue and in the world of fashion? Join Vogue Club, a one-of-a-kind fashion community where you can unlock exclusive access to Vogue editors, industry players, and fellow members, as well as receive expert style advice, tickets to VIP events, handpicked gifts, and so much more. Visit VogueClub.com today and get 20% off using promo code TheRunThrough20. That's VogueClub.com, promo code TheRunThrough20. You likely know Chelsea Manning as the person responsible for one of the most high-profile document leaks in recent history. But she's also a new author and a fashion historian in her own right. We recently spoke to her from her apartment in Brooklyn.
Yes, we loved hearing what she's been up to, from security consulting to DJing.
DJing wearing cat ears, mind you. Yes, that's Chelsea DJing this summer in Williamsburg.
Oh, that's so cool. Back in 2017, shortly after her release from prison, Annie Leibovitz shot her for Vogue.
It was at Coney Island. There was howling, awful winds, which you can see in the photograph. And I was basically, the entire time I was being sandblasted by by the New York coast.
Oh my God.
I remember when you posted it on Instagram and then it was like, the caption was, you know, guess this is what freedom looks like. What was it like putting that image out in the world? And tell us a bit about that moment.
So, you know, I was very new to Instagram. I had just been released from prison. And yeah, you know, the reaction seemed pretty positive and very good. And I recall that I think it was a few days or maybe a week later, some troll tried to attack me on Twitter. And my response, I had this viral response on Twitter, which was basically, it was like, you should have been shot for the crimes that you did. My response was, well, I got shot for Vogue instead.
Oh my God, amazing. And anyone who hasn't seen that gorgeous picture, that beautiful red, it was a Norma Kamali swimsuit, I think, right? We just go see it.
I still have it.
Yeah, it's such a great suit. She makes the best swimsuits, yeah. I have to say. I'm a big fan. Everyone should go read about it on Vogue.com.
It's an iconic.
Yeah, it's iconic. And see that image. It's an iconic image.
Chelsea, I really enjoyed reading your book, readme.txt. Will you tell us a bit about it and when you started writing it and also where the title comes from?
My initial manuscript was written while I was still in prison.
Oh, wow.
So I had something like 200 odd pages of paper because I had to print out everything. I didn't have like a disk that I could put anything on. So it was a.
But you were had access. You typed it on the computer. You weren't writing longhand.
Right. You know, we had access to a computer. There was definitely an initial manuscript. It mostly comes from the fact that one of the parts of the process of the disclosures was me outlining sort of what the documents that were released were, at least from my opinion, to anyone who would receive them, Washington Post, New York Times, eventually it was WikiLeaks. But, you know, we went through this process of trying to figure out who would do that. So I didn't have an idea of who was going to receive this or publish this at this time. But this document basically just outlines, like, this is what 21st century asymmetric warfare is. This is a historical record of these things. And that is the genesis of the book title.
I mean, I have to say, for me, the parts of the book that were just the most gripping and visceral were the segments in prison. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us, obviously you've dedicated several chapters to this, but can you just explain a little bit to people what being in solitary confinement does to a person mentally and physically?
Everything is 10 times more vivid, right? Your senses just become hyper aware of everything, you know? So a door slam in another part of the building, footsteps, footfall.
Interesting.
You know, you can recognize people based on footfall. Like you can tell what person, you know, the mood of a person is based on their footfall
wow.
and the distance. You know, the drips from the pipes in the walls. Everything becomes, because you have so little stimuli to experience, your mind focuses and hyper-focuses on that.
And then after Quantico, you are moved to being in, I guess it's not, is it general population and a military person? Do you call it the same thing?
Yeah. So general population is everybody. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ominous, ominous, everybody.
But despite identifying as a woman, you were moved into a men's military prison.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the unique challenges that you faced because of that situation, that scenario?
Well, the biggest challenge that I had was access to care. The military, and even, you know, my own lawyers from trial sort of were very skeptical of the idea that the military would, you know, provide access to care. You know, the basics of transitioning, male to female transitioning. Yeah, so access to care became my priority because whenever you get a long sentence, like, you know, I was given a 35-year sentence, the way that my mind was sort of working for survival mode was like, I need to improve my quality of life, right? You know, like, it's not about getting out of prison. It's about improving quality of life. You know, how can I make this life that I have left as livable and as survivable as possible? And access to care was very important. So I worked with the American Civil Liberties Union to legally pressure the government and the military and the prison to provide me with access to care. And we succeeded in part. It was a lengthy process, but in February 2015, I got access to hormones. And in late 2016, we had at least the acknowledgement that access to bottom surgery would be provided.
I'm curious to know, did you set a precedent at the time? And
There's actually a long history of this. This really started in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. It was a part of a long tradition of this, that the sort of using the courts to pressure prisons to do the right thing. And it came on the heels of that.
I was really struck by a lot of the very specific moments in prison that you described. And there was one scene you talk about in the barbershop about sort of the empathy of fellow prisoners that I would love if you could talk to us a little bit about.
The barbershop was, even though it was inmates being barbers for other inmates, they needed certification in the state of Kansas, which required them to do all kinds of beautician type work as well. So
sure.
Eyebrows and things like that. So they would use me as best as they could to practice, you know, different various things on. It made the blow a little less. I still didn't like it, but this wasn't like somebody coming along and just going, you know.
I found that very touching.
Did you become a student of fashion in prison?
I've been a student of fashion for a very long time. One of the interesting things I think is exceptionally interesting is fashion history.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just the current trends. But one of the things that I've had a long, this goes even before I was in the military, is this interest that I have in how tailoring and how there's been changes in tailoring methods, there's been changes in the fabrics, the kinds of designs, the kinds of patterns, the kinds of, you know, cuts for different clothing over the period of time, how much the Second World War altered the fashion landscape,
yeah.
How much, you know, rationing of various materials shaped it.
What excites you about fashion now?
I am extremely fascinated by the sort of post-pandemic suits that we've been seeing,
okay.
Where tailors, there are an increasing number of tailor houses that are doing custom or bespoke suits, fitted suits, you know, which is traditionally a male thing. If you're a woman, you'd get your suit off the rack at Zara, right?
That's
or at Ann Taylor. But now there are an increasing number of houses, you know, like your Savile Row type houses that accommodate women.
I want a bespoke suit. Do you have a bespoke suit?
I do. Well, I mean, I don't have it in my possession yet.
Did you go pinstripe? What did you order?
Tweed.
It's basically a three-piece suit that I've added pockets to and, you know, various other features in it that, you know, will essentially be my daily driver for doing business, especially in Europe.
Amazing.
Amazing. I love that.
Chelsea, I'm curious about your DJing that you're up to. How'd you get into that?
So, yeah, so I started DJing in the early 2000s.
Before you enlisted?
Before I was even out of secondary school.
Oh, wow.
I wasn't even out of secondary school then. So I did, in fact, try to become a professional DJ in the mid-2000s in the U.S. And I obviously did not succeed. I am not Calvin Harris. I've been trying to start DJing again, mostly for fun.
Right.
You know, just because I really appreciate music. I live in Brooklyn, so obviously many of my friends are electronic musicians. And that's what I've been doing. To try to have a little fun, a little pizzazz to my life.
I love that. And What do you wear for DJing?
I have been wearing a suit where I just wear the trousers and the vest or waistcoat. Or in the alternative, I will wear some vintage pants that are sort of leathery in nature. I think that they're vintage leather. And I wear that with a mesh top. And my favorite feature is I wear it with these LED, very colorful, going into different patterns, cat ears.
Amazing.
Amazing.
Can you just tell us a little bit more about dedicating the book to trans kids? I found that quite moving.
Well, I was a trans kid once.
Right.
So that's my main audience for this book in my mind whenever I was writing it was, you know, and this is the kind of role model that I try to be. And today is I just try to be the person that, as close to the person that I kind of needed whenever I was a teenager.
Right.
It's just a little acknowledgement that, hey, I see you. I hear you. I know you're there. You are loved and you are cared about. Enough for me to dedicate this book to you.
It's been such a pleasure, and congratulations on your new book.
Thank you.
And good luck behind the decks. And honestly, we'll be watching.
Wonderful.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
The Run Through with Vogue is a production of Condé Nast Entertainment. If you're enjoying our show, please make sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen.
If you want to reach out to us, send us a note to therunthrough@vogue.com. We'd love to hear from you.
I'm Chloe Mel.
And I'm Cho Minardi. And we'll be back next week.
Ciao.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.